Did you ever hear about 52 Blue, who we thought was the world's loneliest whale? Or Haldimir, the beluga whale allegedly trained as a Russian spy who escaped and became a global celebrity? Or maybe your bucket list includes glimpsing Migaloo, the rare Australian albino whale? I feel that whale stories have fascinated humans for a long time, right through Moby Dick to these online sensations. And it's the same for wildlife scientist Vanessa Perotta. She's written a book about her experiences with these incredible creatures and what they might be able to teach us about being human. It's called Humpback Highway, Diving into the Mysterious World of Whales. Vanessa Perotta, welcome to Life Matters.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
It's great to speak about whales. I don't know anyone who doesn't love whales, but you write that you might be addicted to them. When did that start?
Oh, from a very, very young age. And I think it was the upbringing that I had, which was away from the ocean. So I'm talking about 3 hours from the closest beach on a farm outside of Canberra. And I saw whales in books and on TV and then in the movie Free Willy. And so it's just this incredible excitement that I got from looking at these bizarre creatures that really prompted me to ask questions about them and want to know more.
Well, and that's interesting, isn't it? Because you started small and then you ended up a wildlife scientist. What was the pathway?
Well, when I was a little girl, I always thought that the thing I wanted to do when I was a big kid was essentially a dolphin trainer. And so that's the only thing I was going to do, and that would be it forever. And what was exciting is that I've since learned that there's so many other things I've been able to do, and I'm now doing things I never thought was possible post being a dolphin trainer.
It was lovely reading through your book, Humpback Highway, about all the different things that you've done and how you had this turning point experience where you realised you wanted to know more about whales and then just pestered a whale scientist until they let you do that. Why are whales so fascinating to you? I mean, they're large, but there are other things about them, isn't there?
Absolutely. It's the way they look. It's the fact that they can swim in the ocean from a place, from one part of the world to another. And I've only learnt this even only a few years ago. How do they navigate? How do they see the world? How do they understand the things that they do? And I think it's the bizarre sort of parts of whales as a child that I would see, such as their pointy end, which is their mouth, coming out of the water. I had no idea of what that was in the books that I still have to this day. And so it was really interesting. And also the fact that it's only the small glimpses that we see when we see a whale, rather, it's just this little snapshot and then they're gone. It leaves me wanting to know more.
Well, that's the key, one of the key parts of the book, isn't it? That we just don't know that much about them. Why is it so hard to learn about whales?
Well, the good thing is that we don't have to kill whales anymore to learn about them. And so that used to be one of the ways that us as humans would have to do it. This was alongside whaling. Fortunately, in majority of the world, we don't kill whales anymore to eat them or to learn more about them through the science world. And so they are, I would say, not the easiest of animals to work on, because for some, they can be the size of a bus. They can hold their breath for a long time. Some can even hold their breath for up to 3 hours plus. I mean, that is amazing. And for most of the time, they spend time offshore, out of sight. And thankfully, science is allowing us to spy on them in ways that we would have never thought possible. I'm talking about from the land, by placing tags on them, even spying on whales in space. So it is getting a little bit easier, but you do have to enter the water, at least be on the water to get closer to them to ask a bit more questions. But we are doing that now, as I said before, from places like space, which is really exciting.
Yep, though I guess when you introduce the ocean as a variable, that tends to spin out any field trip a little bit longer than others. Tell me a bit more, Vanessa, about whale snot and why that's useful for us working out the health of the oceans.
We did just say whale snot nationally around Australia. For those who don't know, whale snot is essentially lung bacteria coming from a whale. So this is where I'm going to take your ears on a visual journey. So when a whale, they breathe air like you and I. And so when they breathe, they come to the surface and it sounds just like this. You ready? Ready. So that's a whale going, oh, I've just run a race, or I've held my breath for a bit. and I'm going to take some air. Now, when they do that, it produces this juicy snapshot for us to collect in terms of their health information. And we can collect that via the use of drones, which was a main component of my PhD. And what we're able to collect is essentially the smallest creatures from one of the largest creatures on Earth. And so we're looking at the microbiota, or also known as microbiome, from their lungs. And this is essentially giving us an internal snapshot or a small idea of the internal health of whales that we're sampling from, and in this case from my research, we do this on relatively healthy whales, but we can then compare the whale snot samples to other whales around the world and of those that might be sick. And so essentially for your listeners, it's like the ultimate PCR sample from a whale without us having to put a little something up their nose, or in their case, down their nose.
Well, so if we're looking at the, you know, the bacteria that come out of whales and working out how healthy or otherwise they are, what does that tell us about the state of the oceans, particularly under climate change?
Of course. This is a really great question, and I've kind of diverted around the previous one. But it is, if we're able to collect bacteria, or in our case, we were the world's first to collect viruses from whales via the use of a drone. And one of the viruses we collected that always stayed in my mind was this McMurdo virus that was associated with McMurdo ice shelf down in Antarctica. So what this is telling us is that this animal that we sampled off Bondi Beach off Australia in Sydney was in fact in the areas down in Antarctica, which we know they go to, but it really hit home that these animals are collecting information about our ocean and transporting these to areas like Australian waters. And if we can detect changes in perhaps viruses as well as bacteria, over time, it may provide a snapshot of what is happening in the ocean. So if we go from 1 year collecting samples and we're picking up X, Y, and Z, and then in the next few years, there might be changes in whale populations, but also that might be reflective in the changes that we see in their internal health. This might be indications that there's something might be going on in the population health that might be reflective of changes in our ocean's health. And whales are kind of like the canary in the coal mine for our ocean. They can tell us if things are going good down south in Antarctica or not, or their feeding in Australian waters might be indicative that we might have productive seas here, or perhaps these animals are having to supplement where they feed, because are they getting enough food resources down in Antarctica? With the changing environment like climate change, we might see a reduction, or we are in fact seeing a reduction in sea ice, which is the main home for Antarctic krill, their main food source.
You're hearing the passion and excitement in the voice of wildlife scientist Vanessa Perotta. She's written a book called Humpback Highway, Diving into the Mysterious World of Whales, which is based on her years of research with these large and incredible and kind of wondrous animals. I don't know why it is, but I went on a whale watching tour once and just felt this sense of awe and wonder. And the Humpback Highway, of course, is the migration corridor on the east coast of Australia. Vanessa, you're one of the few people to have the experience of seeing a whale called Migaloo, which is a kind of very rare albino whale. Tell us just briefly why he's become so famous.
He's become famous because he's different. Most of the humpback whales that we see on the Humpback Highway, which are over 40,000 of them, to me as a scientist and other scientists, they look different. But for the average person seeing a whale, they look the same. Migaloo has become, he is white. We know it's he because of genetic testing. He has become this needle in the haystack that people want to see. Where is he? Where is he gone? And people can connect to him because he looks different, but people can easily identify him and go, oh my gosh, I've seen Migaloo. And when I first saw him, and I speak about this in my opening chapter of my book, he does look like a giant iceberg swimming underwater.
Wow. Well, there's a couple of other amazing whales that we should touch on today. 52 Blue, which was a whale that had an unusually high song, wasn't it? And people were worried that perhaps other whales couldn't hear him. Tell us a bit about him.
Oh, yes, yes. So he's become an acoustic superstar, in my opinion, because people were going, oh, you know, is he able to talk? We refer to him as a he, but when we, as a scientist, we can identify different species based on the sounds that they make. And so the idea was that he was calling and calling, and was his sounds being heard? The ocean is becoming ever so loud with ships. We've got small boats with like a ning and then boom, boom, boom. boom, 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 which is a low frequency sound of a big shipping container. But we also have other sounds like underwater construction and deliberate sonar. Is the calls of this very one whale being drowned out? Is he able to talk to others like whales are meant to be able to do so over kilometres across the ocean? Whereas we as humans are reducing available space for these animals to talk to each other across long distances. So people, this is a great example that I like to use as well when people are concerned about some of the impacts that we are making, both visible and those that are not visible.
Well, there was another fascinating story too about Haldimir, which is this beluga whale that kind of popped up in 2019 and people worked out that he had escaped from a training facility that Russia ran, with, you know, and the United States has them too, where they train cetaceans to assist naval forces, let's say, in quote marks. But it really throws into light, doesn't it, the way that humans are both fascinated by whales but also struggle to work out the best way to take care of them.
That's right. And Haldimir is a great example. He's like the Free Willy Mark II, in my opinion. He's currently still swimming around in the waters of Norway in the Northern Hemisphere. And people are watching where he goes because, well, it is most likely he was trained, because you don't just have a beluga whale wearing a harness. And as an ex-dolphin trainer, it takes a bit of time to get these animals accustomed to doing that. And for the animal to know that, hey, there's humans. I know humans. They're fun. People are fascinated by him because it's kind of like this, okay, so we want him to be safe, but we also want him to be free. But if he's free, he's being a bit cheeky and he goes to the salmon farmers and annoys them. But if he's free, people also want to go and see him and connect with him. But then we also want him to not be hurt by anywhere. And if he wants to have a sleep under a boat, we don't want the general public going up to have a selfie with him. So there's this really conflicting place that we're at with him, and he's a great example of that.
Well, yeah, there's been a lot of kind of cross-nation attempts to find a sanctuary or somewhere that he can be safe, but it's not come to anything yet, has it?
No, and the other thing we've seen in the most extreme case, the walrus, oh my gosh, her name just went past Sophie. No, I'm so sorry, I forgot her name, but they had a walrus that visited, and in she was unfortunately euthanized because it was deemed the most appropriate thing to do to reduce public interactions and their safety. So is this the most extreme thing we do? I would say probably not. There are other ways to go about it. And there are passionate people who are following this one individual. It is an incredible story. And as long as he persists and lives and does his thing, there will be dedicated people watching on. And there has been calls to potentially put him into a enclosed area that is still in the wild, but it essentially is a captive environment, but in the wild. But then there's a conflicting way of thinking, well, he's just going back to captivity. So he's able to feed himself, which is good. And we beg the question, you know, scientists always informing, how do we manage human and wildlife interactions and for the best? In fact, I wrote a conversation article about just that. So that's a really interesting piece about how we as scientists can help manage these interactions for the better for both the animals, but also the public safety.
Well, yeah, and they're such big business too, aren't they? They're incredibly valuable to keep in captivity for entertainment purposes. There are about 3,500, I think, whales, dolphins and porpoises still living in confinement around the planet. Should they be in captivity, Vanessa? Because the research is showing that they have genuine forms of culture. They're intelligent and self-aware.
That is a really fantastic question. I would say that for most of the world, we now have a remnant population that will remain in captivity without introductions of new other animals. And I will also point out that for some species, some individuals, they are genuinely rescue creatures that are unable to or have had attempts previously to be returned to the wild. We have the very famous dugong here in Sydney, Pig, who was a failed case. We wanted him to go back to the wild. He tried, but then unfortunately he's now remains in captivity. So, but there are other places around the world which will deliberately capture animals for entertainment. We do need to see both sides of the story. Whilst there are animals that remain in captivity, these animals need, we have an obligation to look after them. We need to ensure that they're well looked after. We've put them in that position, but we need to now go forward ensuring that our education doesn't just rely on captive environments, but does in fact use science to go forward to do other things. But as scientists, we also learn from those animals that are in captive environments, which have become ambassador animals. And like I said, there will probably remain or be remnant populations that will see those animals that are currently in facilities being there and not replaced. So it's a very interesting topic. We could talk about this an entire hour or more.
Exactly. Yeah, it's always going to be complicated. Well, as is the issue of, you know, how we manage our connection with whales. I mean, I talked about having gone on the whale watching boat. Some people try and interact with them by swimming with them in organised or not ways. Are those activities good for whales, or does it depend how they're managed?
Oh, that's also a super big question. So I had the privilege of going to Tonga back in 2013 and ever since, and they had just officially put out Tongan whale watching regulations to try and manage this interaction. And there are other places around the world where people do swim with whales. So I've seen it from the scientific perspective, but also I wanted to experience it as well from the tourist perspective. And I can tell you now, people are not going to stop swimming with whales. In Australia, though, I must point out, we have amazing national and also state and one territory guidelines for making sure we keep whales safe, but also keeping us safe. People will continue with operators and other areas where there are swim with programs. They will continue to do this. There are in the scientific literature evidence to suggest that certain swim behaviours, particularly from my laboratory group, the Marine Predator Research Group at Macquarie University, which shows that some swimming interactions are less disturbing than others. But there are clear evidence elsewhere as well that swimming does alter the behaviour of whales. In some cases, this is short term, but the long term interactions is also questionable. We don't know how much the long term impacts might have. So again, people are not going to stop swimming with whales, but what we need to do is we need to manage this in a way that's sustainable for both the whales and the humans. And how can we best do this going forward? Because people naturally love and have a curiosity for whales. And it's through whale watching, whale swimming, and different ways people will continue to go about this and have that closeness to them. But for some, they don't need to do that. They can learn about them. They can listen like we're listening right now to have that connection. And we can learn through the scientific world. There is just such an immense pathway forward that we need to keep learning about how we can manage these interactions for the better.
And people can also read about them in Humpback Highway, Diving into the Mysterious World of Whales. Vanessa Perotta, thanks so much for chatting with us about your book and about whales today.
Thank you, and I hope you see the whales in Australian waters very soon.
Oh, me too. Vanessa's a wildlife scientist as well as an author, has been a dolphin trainer, and what a fantastic, interesting pathway to where she is now. And I guess it just goes to show that perhaps a bit more whale science would be useful when we work out the impacts of our behaviours on them.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.